Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello and welcome. I'm Alice DeBoos. I'm managing partner of Kingston Reid, and
I'm Lucy Shanahan, partner at Kingston Reid.
And this is the second in our series of podcasts about managing investigations in New South Wales Health. We went through in the last episode the processes and preparation under the Managing Misconduct Policy, as this is the holy grail of investigation information for local health districts when it comes to looking into complaints in the workplace. So what are we going to talk about this podcast?
Well, after listening to the last podcast and reading the policy, because hopefully you have done that after listening to our last podcast, you're now ready to launch in and get the investigation done. So that is what we are going to be talking about in this podcast.
All right, I'm primed. I am ready for action. Where do I start, Lucy?
Well, the first thing you need to do as an investigator is to really clearly articulate the purpose of the investigation before you do anything else. So that really means that you need to ascertain or work out for yourself why you are investigating the grievance and what are you trying to achieve with the investigation.
It doesn't sound hard, but it's a really common problem, isn't it? I can tell you I've seen so many times that people complete an investigation report and they still don't seem to have clarity on exactly what it was they're investigating in the first place. Fundamental flaw. You have to work out what you're investigating. You have to work out the purpose of your inquiry, because that will make for a better report and more sound findings.
Yeah, that's right. And it'll actually link the findings to the facts in the report, which is essential if you want to.
But another common flaw.
Yeah, that's right. As we discussed in our last podcast, the initial review really should have identified the brief for the investigator and the matters to be investigated. So in order to begin the investigation, you need to know what the allegations are and how they relate to the particular precise policy, code, or guideline under which the allegations have been made or the allegations of the breach have arisen. And remember, there's really only very limited circumstances where an investigation is required. And that's really where there's a factual dispute or where misconduct has been identified or there's been a determination that the allegations are credible. So it's not something that you just have to do because someone has demanded it.
And before you start with interviewing anyone, you actually need to do a bit of paperwork, right? You need to gather all the relevant documents. If someone has made what appears to be a bullying investigation, have you got the right policy that says that you shouldn't bully people? If someone has breached a particular operating procedure, have you got a copy of the correct operating procedure and have you highlighted the section that is alleged to have been breached? Other things that you should gather, any written evidence. So are there emails? Are we talking about an allegation involving someone emailing rude things to someone else in the workplace? It doesn't happen as much as it used to, but that kind of thing. Get the emails first. You shouldn't be doing anything without gathering the information that is in your power to gather beforehand. CCTV footage, security records of any description, these types of evidence that relate to the allegations should be gathered before you do anything. I think it should also be done before you alert any of the participants. Two key reasons here. Firstly, you need to provide all of the relevant policies and procedures to both the complainant and the respondent at the outset, but also because you want to ensure that you protect the evidence from destruction and inform yourself before you start. No point not gathering the emails first, letting everyone know that you're investigating email traffic, then to go and try and find the emails only to find that they have been deleted. So you need to gather all of that information first before you talk to anyone.
And that the risk of destruction of emails and other documents is a real problem. You know, we always tell everybody that it's almost impossible for an email to be completely deleted, but they certainly can be made very, very difficult to find. And it actually can cost quite a lot to do an IT search. So it's really important that steps are taken to protect the destruction of that email and that the requisite IT searches and CCTV footage is reviewed.
Yeah, that's right. And then I always take some time to really carefully review all of the information, the allegations and the evidence first before I take the next step, which is to prepare the letters to the complainant, respondent and any witnesses, because I want to be armed with all the information that is humanly possible before I actually ask anyone any questions.
Yeah, and also that letter to the various witnesses and respondent is really important and actually is the one of the first essential steps in ensuring procedural fairness is afforded to the various participants.
That's in the policy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so you actually need to be, if you're preparing the letter to the respondent or to the witnesses, then you actually really need to be across all of the allegations so that you can properly put them into the letter by reference to the relevant facts as well as the relevant policies. The letter for the complainant is a bit different. In that letter, you need to set out what the allegations are that you're investigating, so what the investigator has actually been asked to do. And sometimes that will differ from what the complainant actually wants you to investigate. So, for example, a complainant might have come to their manager with a complaint that contains 8 allegations, for example, against a respondent. But during the initial review, perhaps only 4 or 5 of those are identified as potential misconduct or where there is a significant factual dispute. So it's really important that the investigator is clear that it's only that limited number that are actually being investigated and nothing else. Mm. And the complainant may ask you why. So you need to be prepared to explain why not all of the allegations that they've made are subject to the investigation. And the letter to the complainant also needs to remind them about confidentiality, the contact points that they've got, and also the support that they can get through the EAP.
Confidentiality is really important, isn't
it? It's huge.
But it's confidentiality for them,
yep,
not for the investigator,
isn't
it?
It's confidentiality for them. It protects them, it protects the witnesses, it protects the respondent. The investigator can undertake to keep the investigation as confidential as possible, but there are going to be circumstances where they will need to ask a variety of people questions, so they can't make a promise of confidentiality to the complainant.
That's right. Never, ever, ever make a promise of confidentiality, I think is a cardinal rule if you work in HR, full stop. You also have to send letters to the witnesses. That's set out in the policy as well. These are reasonably simple. They only need to identify that they're potential witnesses and you'd like to talk to them. But these also have to have a reminder about confidentiality and a reminder about victimisation. Victimisation is something that is specifically prohibited by law, but also by the policy. And there needs to be a reminder about the evils of victimisation in all of these correspondence. But the letter to the respondent is probably the most important, because this is the one that is more likely to end up in the hands of lawyers or union officials. There is guidance as to what it needs to contain in the policy and information sheet 7. It doesn't need to have full detail of the allegation. That is a very common response, particularly if the respondent is represented by a union. A union will more often than not come back to you and say, the full details of the allegations need to be set out before my member will submit him or herself to an interview. Not true, but the policy does set out that it needs to have enough information to allow for a considered response. So they need to know what it is that they're responding to and have enough information in there so that they can provide a considered response, either in person or in writing. The respondent has a right to a support person, and we'll talk a little bit about support people later on because they can be a contentious issue. But they also need to be reminded about confidentiality, victimisation, and as always, offer access and support to the employee assistance program.
Yeah. There's, as Alice said, there's support people can raise a number of difficult issues. The position, and this is reflected in the procedure, is that a support person is there for support only. So they're there to call for a break or take notes or provide the person who's being interviewed with tissues if they, you know, get a bit teary. They should very rarely speak. They're not, their job is not to advocate or act as a representative for the person who's being interviewed. And that can be quite tricky if the support person is a union official. They sometimes like to just cross the line. Well, that's been my experience anyway.
Well, I think it's difficult for them to simply sit back rather than to advocate. That's their job, is to advocate. And I think that they often find this a very difficult role.
Yeah, and also it's difficult for them when they hear their member answering a question and in the answer covering ground that the union official didn't want them to cover. So often... But I always take the opportunity at the outset of an interview to remind the support person of what their role is, that they're there as a support person, that the interview is with the interviewee, that I need the interviewee to actually respond to the questions that I'm asking. And if you do that at the outset, if you do have issues with the support person during the interview, you can refer back to when you sort of gave those instructions. The other thing is that a support person shouldn't be someone who is going to be a witness in the investigation. They need to be someone who's completely separate to the investigation, which is why it's really important that you have a list of people who you've identified as potential witnesses. So if you're informed of the of a support person who appears on your list of witnesses, you can tell them that they can't have that person. They need to choose someone else.
When it comes to the actual interviews, doing them well comes down to a combination of two things, I think: experience and preparation. But never fear, very good preparation will certainly be a substitute for you while you build your experience. Never, ever, ever wander into an interview without proper preparation. First of all, you've got to carefully plan the order of your interviews. As a general rule, I always start with the complainant because I need to get as much information about what is the substance of the complaint as possible before I speak to anyone else. Then I speak to the witnesses, and then I speak to the respondent. This means I have all of the information before I speak to the respondent, and it usually reduces the need to go back to people for a second interview. But you've got to be flexible. This may not always be the best way to proceed. Always leave open the possibility that you'll need to go back to a person to ask some additional questions. Always leave that avenue open at the end of every interview. And you can go back via email or phone. You don't have to bring everyone together again. You might simply be trying to clarify a point. Don't cut corners because on particular pieces of evidence because you don't want to go back to someone and ask a particular question. Always just go back and ask that additional question.
Yeah. The other part of preparation for the interview is actually writing the questions, isn't it?
Yeah.
I always make sure that I've drafted the questions which are necessary and which go to the heart of the allegations. And then I try to tick them off against the allegations that are set out in the letter, in the interview, to ensure that I've covered everything off. But it's really important that as part of your preparing those questions, that you think about the different avenues that that might become open to you during the interview. So that you might be questioning someone about a particular issue, and they might say something which requires you to completely change tack or to ask different questions as to those that you had actually prepared. And that will depend entirely upon the answers that you get. So it's really important too that you ask open questions. So those are questions where the answer is not just yes or no, and where you're inviting the person who's answering the question to give you a fulsome answer so they have an opportunity to give you detail. Another trick that we often use...
Well, what's an example of that?
Oh, goodness.
Did I just ask an open question?
You just did ask an open question. I always say, the example that I often give is an open question might be something like, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Now, that invites a range of responses. You could say, I had coffee and a piece of toast at my favourite cafe. Or you could say, well, it's Shrove Tuesday today, so Mum decided that we would have pancakes and that's what we did and they were delicious. So it just gives a person an opportunity to provide much more information. And make sure you listen. Make sure you listen.
As opposed to saying, did you have pancakes for breakfast this morning?
That's right. Absolutely.
And then there's only a yes or no answer.
That's right.
Yeah.
The other thing that you need to be really careful of is to make sure that your questions just contain one subject matter. You're not asking double-barreled questions. So one, you know, you don't want to say, what did you do when you on Tuesday when you went through the door and spoke to? You need to just one topic per question so that the person can just focus on that. And the other trick I like to use when I'm asking questions, if I don't think I've got enough of an answer, I just use silence.
Mm.
I just will ask the question, the person will respond, and then I won't say anything. And everyone feels compelled to fill the silence. So you'll often get more information that way too.
That's how I deal with my teenage son too. Just by the way, it's a very, very effective technique for getting information out of uncooperative witnesses. I think there are probably a few other important logistical issues that we should come up with, that we should deal with, that come up with interviews. One of those is location. Make sure it's somewhere appropriate. It may need to be in the hospital or workplace, or it might be completely inappropriate that it's at work and that you might need to think of doing it at another facility. I've done plenty of witness interviews that are at people's homes as well. Bear in mind that these are very often very sensitive situations. People don't want to be seen talking to you, particularly if you're an outsider in that particular facility. So just have a bit of a sensitive think about where might be the most appropriate place to conduct your interview. And really importantly, make sure you have all the relevant documents to show during the investigation, and that means all of the relevant policies as well as any evidence. You cannot rely on it unless you show it to the respondent and get their explanation. So if you're asking the respondent about a particular policy, you should have that policy in front of them and be drawing their attention to the relevant sections and be asking them about it. If you want to ask a respondent about a piece of CCTV footage, you need to show it to them and get their response to it during that interview.
That's right. And that's really important in ensuring that the factual decisions or the decisions that you made about, you know, whether or not the alleged conduct occurred can be tied back to the evidence as well. The other really important thing you need to think about is how you're actually going to record the interviews. So the procedure requires that people involved in an investigation are provided with a summary of the interview for review and for their signature as soon as possible. Now, obviously, the best way to get a correct record of what's being discussed in an interview is to actually record it, i.e. with a, you know, with some sort of recording device. But that will require consent. So you'll need to cover that off and get consent at the beginning. You'll also need to ensure that you have an arrangement in place where that, you know, what is recorded can actually be typed out or turned into some sort of a transcript as well, which can be quite time consuming. But if the idea is to actually physically record the interview, then you need to ensure that you've got that consent process built in at the beginning of your interview. If consent is not given, or you don't want the interview to be recorded and you need to take notes, then there is a process for dealing with disputes about the interview record in the procedure. And in simple terms, the dispute needs to be in writing, and if it's unresolved, all of the dispute needs to be attached to the investigation report.
The other tricky aspects to conducting an interview will arise, say, if someone refuses to cooperate, or if they don't show up for interviews, or I've had people come along but sit there and not answer questions. How do we deal with those kind of tricky aspects?
Yeah, and that is a really tricky aspect, particularly if the advice that they've received is not to
participate. Don't answer questions.
Yeah, don't answer questions. Like, turn up so that you're participating, but then you don't actually provide any information.
Generally bad advice, right?
Yeah, not great advice. If we start from first principles, if the person that you're interviewing is a New South Wales Health employee, then they actually have a duty to cooperate and comply with a reasonable direction. And participating in an investigation and answering questions is a reasonable direction. And you can actually put that into the letter to the witnesses in an investigation. Ultimately, the end result of someone not giving information is that it becomes more difficult for you as the investigator to make a decision, because you can only make a decision based upon the information that is in front of you. And it may be that you don't have the information to substantiate a particular allegation. The direction on the process to follow if this happens is in the procedure, and essentially it becomes a disciplinary issue as it's considered a breach of the code of conduct.
Yeah, so then it takes a different path,
yes,
doesn't it?
That's right.
Entirely, and you deal with it under a different policy. we touched on this in a very quickly in the earlier podcast, but sometimes people are on leave.
Yep.
And I find this can be complex because delay really is a killer for investigations, but there does need to be enough flexibility in any time frame to deal with leave and to deal with sickness. In the main, the way that you'll deal with this will depend on the type of leave.
Yep.
And the type of allegations. For example, if it's annual leave, there might be some circumstances where it will be appropriate to recall someone from leave. Now, I think it would have to be pretty serious and the allegations would have to be urgent. So you're talking about very serious misconduct allegations, I would say unlawful conduct that needed to be dealt with very quickly. Then you can recall someone from leave. But generally speaking, most interviews can wait a couple of weeks till someone returns. But say it's long service leave and someone's away for a couple of months, you weigh up the prejudice caused by the delay and inconvenience of disturbing someone who's on long service leave. If it means waiting a couple of months, to be honest, I'd err on the side of contacting the person and interviewing them while they're on leave if possible.
Yeah.
I would not want New South Wales Health to be paying an employee who was stood down or suspended during a whole period while someone was on long service leave and that was delaying the investigation. So there's a little bit of judgment here, but generally speaking, I think it is governed by the type of leave that is being taken and the seriousness of the allegations.
But sick leave or workers' comp is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that the medical condition of the employee prevents them from participating in the investigation, but that's a question that can only really be determined by a medical professional. It's not something that we as lawyers or HR practitioners can actually determine. So, for example, if someone has a broken leg and is unfit for work as a consequence of their broken leg, then they're probably likely to be fit to be interviewed because... Yeah.
You have to go to their house.
That's right.
They're still fit to be interviewed.
Yeah, and that can be, you know, you can make arrangements with them about when best to interview them. However, if the medical condition is related to, for example, a mental health issue, then it may be that the medical advice is that they're not well enough to be subject to an interview. But again, that has to be a decision that is made by a treating practitioner. And it may be that you need to get in contact with that person's medical practitioner or get an IME to find out if they are going to be well enough to participate in the investigation. There are guidelines on how to do this in the New South Wales Public Sector Procedures for Managing Non-Work-Related Injuries and Health Conditions. Another policy. But, you know, sometimes it might be possible, for example, to provide information by written statement rather than interview. And that can be a really good way of managing it.
Of course, one issue that delays investigations is performance management and counter allegations.
Bullying.
I can hear a deep sigh at the other end on our listeners' end because no doubt you've come across this before. We're not dealing with that in this podcast, but our colleagues will be dealing with that in a further podcast in this series because that is very common and a very tricky spanner to be thrown in the works of investigations. The reason why we rabbit on about delay so much is it's one of the most common fairness concerns that are raised where, say, termination is the result of an investigation. Someone trots along to the Industrial Relations Commission and files an unfair dismissal. Delay in an investigation is one of the most common elements of unfairness that the Commission will consider. The procedure states that an investigation should be completed within 12 weeks. That's in information sheet 2 for reference. But as I said earlier, I just don't think any investigation should take anywhere near that long. As a rule of thumb, the investigator should have everything else taken off his and her plate so that they can conduct the investigation within a couple of weeks. Say it's an allegation involves up to 4 witnesses and no one's on leave. That really can be done within a couple of weeks. All of the interviews should be scheduled with that in mind. This may sound difficult. You may be rolling your eyes and saying, I can't possibly do that. But this is part of ensuring that the right person is selected to do the investigation and ensuring that that person has the resources available at his or her fingertips to be able to get it conducted within a fair time frame.
That it's also important because the longer the investigation gets drawn out, the harder it is for the investigator to draw conclusions.
Absolutely.
Because you lose, you know, you lose the context, you get, you know, your memory about the evidence starts to fade. It's just, it's better that it's done in a much shorter period of time.
And witnesses forget.
Yeah.
Can barely remember what I did last week, let alone what I might have said to a colleague a year ago. Mm. So the fresher the evidence, the better quality the evidence is, the better your conclusions are going to be.
That's right. And one last curly issue that comes up is if it becomes clear during the interview that the complaint is vexatious or misconceived. Now, ideally, that should be identified in the initial review. But if it's not and it becomes clear during the investigation, then the investigation should stop, and the reason for the investigation being stopped should be recorded. The respondent should be notified, and, you know, an apology might actually be appropriate.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, the person who made the vexatious complaint could be subject then to, for example, a disciplinary procedure or something like that.
That's exactly right. And, of course, that disciplinary procedure would be governed by another policy. Right, so that's our rundown on actually conducting the investigation with a few curly issues thrown in. In the next podcast, we will deal with the pointy end. How do you form conclusions, and then how do you manage the outcomes?